Yeah, we're taking this down now, so it's still very preliminary. I don't want to draw any conclusions or any windows for what we say here. I'll try to stick just to the facts of the timeline. The thing that we tried to do.
You mean 23 instead of 22 here, somebody?
I didn't write this. If there's a mistake, I'll clean it up as we come. It does mean 23. All right, what we did was to go in to the time where we identified the voice first saying fire.
This is what? A tape that you
this
have?
This is a voice tape, and I'll describe this a bit more at home. And then we took all of the data, which was coming off ACE and any other strip charts and so on. The data wasn't counted, it was reduced. And we then sort of stripped it all out, and what you might call a quick look type operation. Concentrated particularly on essentially a minute before the event as just a rough point in time, up through loss of data, which was at 23:31:18. Okay. The guys then had these strip charts. They weren't time correlated. They went back and then asked for the strip charts to be pulled out now with more accurate analog plots, accurate time correlations between the various events, and then they also had the digital printouts, which really represent the more accurate data. They then went down and identified every channel on which there was any anomalous information. And what I'll give you is the results of that. What they then tried to do is to sort of piece together a timeline, because there turns out to be very little that was anomalous beforehand. And then the timeline may give some indication as to the progress of things inside the spacecraft, which may help trace, may not, but at least there's a certain first cut at what happened. And then it turns out to be a number of questions which can only get answered by some detailed information about switch positions in the spacecraft, and which may then lead to some specific requests for looking at parts of the spacecraft in priority to other parts. But let me try to describe first a general condition before I talk about the data. Because in the pre-time up to here, there were really only, I think, three anomalous indications picked up. One of these was a high heart rate in the EKG, and I'll describe it. There were several bursts of this. The second was an anomaly in the high O2 flow rate. This is the O2 flow rate in the suit loop. We had seen this before, some 10 minutes before the problem, and by discussion between the crew and the ground, at that time the high flow rate, which was also correlated with a drop in the surge tank, was a faceplate open. Gus said he had his faceplate open and he closed it. This particular anomaly that happened in here in the high O2 did not seem to correlate with a drop in the surge tank pressure, so there's an anomaly there that the guys are looking at, and may or may not have represented the faceplate open. All right, now, as far as the events coming in here at 23. We start at 23.
15 seconds
if we find a voice off the This is 23, 31, and the seconds are marked down here. All right. Up there at 3017, there was a short burst of high rate. I think this was white. They were coming along at about a 75 pulse per minute or so. And for a short burst, the pulse rate went up to 110 to 120. This time was correlated with some jiggling in the inertial platform, which may have come from crew movement at that point in time. So we also noticed this jiggling later on again. The thing quieted down until 3052, the pulse rate went 140 to 150. Well, it was still right. I think we could only monitor one guy. There's a switch, and I think it stayed on the one guy all the time. And I believe that it began to calm down again, although it still stayed pretty high. And then at 31037, the voice calls fire, pulse rate is up about 200, which is max. There was a second voice transmission at about 23.6 or 7, I forget which said fire in a cockpit. Deke and I have listened to this. He might want to comment on it, but we think that this was a chassis, that the second transmission, which said fire in the cockpit, was white. There's a third transmission which starts about 12, which says there's really a fire in here, it's bad, and then dies away by about 15 or so. There were some keyings apparently of the S-band transmitter in this time period. I don't completely have the correlation of those keyings to the high heart rates, but they would appear to be in and about this time, and there's a couple of short keying, and then the thing sounds like it's just held open as if somebody's waiting to talk and trying to decide. There is no voice, and we think the loop was clear at that point in time. So there may have been some kind of indications coming along in here that they were getting uncomfortable about, but apparently not uncomfortable enough to call until this point. And that must have been when they first saw the problem. All right.
George, you said something about one of your fellow groups that has to say small. What did you get that?
Okay, it's come off the
tape. The question was somebody with a transcript that said smoke. Now, we've listened to the tape from about 29, I think, Deke, and we've listened to it from 30 on through several times, and there's nothing on there that we heard before this time period. The only, there's an early talk, messages, communications are bad, and but that's down around 27, 28. And the only thing that's going on in here is just keying. There was nothing we could hear. The first voice, you almost can't hear it. It's just very quick. It says fire. And the second transmission is somewhat clearer. It says fire in the cockpit. The third transmission is starts out quick.
On the heartbeat, have you looked farther back to see that, to what extent this kind of anomaly is really an anomaly, or does that thing happen? Is there a baseline of comparison that goes farther back?
I would suggest that the board get the baseline of comparison.
That's 55 to 60 is Ed Wright's normal baseline. That's what he was running right up to this 40, 41 second point.
Had anything like this been going on before, I'm sure the medics would have picked it up and been questioning it. No,
even 110 to 120 is something rather unusual for that particular position.
Well, the rate of onset is unusual.
Yeah, it comes down very quickly. The medical people really ought to talk to the interpretation of this we're giving him. Yeah. All right. The one and only then, the oxygen flow rate, the max flow pegged out, in other words, it went against the stops at a pound per hour flow, which is the top of the reading, 22:30:59:42. In other words, right at this point in time. That could have been, we have to understand what happened there.
Did it stay that way, Joe?
Yeah, it then stayed up there. Oh, it oscillates quite a bit because of crew movement and so on, but it's not pegged in any sense. And if you look at the trace on this chart, it sort of bobbles around half scale or so, maybe less than that on the average. There was a, back, as I said, 10 minutes or so prior to that, there was a bump that came up and pegged, came back down again. That was correlated by voice with the faceplate open. The difference in this thing was that there was a correlation here between the high flow rate and adopting the O2 surge tank. We did not identify such a correlation here, although the total time of the high O2 flow rate here is much lower.
What do we have to do to to determine that this is not an anomaly and simply the indication rather than an indication of an anomaly in the flow?
I would prefer to let the system people who are looking at these kind of things talk with you tomorrow. And if we could look at tonight's briefing as a sort of, here's what we got, here's the raw data we're working with. And I think this is the kind of thing that we can reproduce and check different conditions and so on. We have ECS breadboards, we have complete spacecraft that we can go back in and get these kind of conditions in. It may not be associated with the situation at all. It may merely be a result, for example, of opening a faceplate to look to see what was going on. It could have some bearing on it. All I'm saying is this is what we see.
One other question. Were there quite a few instrumentation or otherwise anomalies after that full reset?
I'll describe all those terms. Everything I've got. Okay. There was, I should say, in the strip charts we were looking at back in this time period, a sort of consistent dropout, which turned out to be instrumentation. If you look at the strip charts, I'm sure you will, you should note that several of the scripts are out. When you go back and look at the digital data, you find that this was just a lack of correlation in the printing process. Okay. And we've examined each of those in detail. Okay. I know that it pegged out 14 minutes earlier, not 10 minutes earlier. It pegged out for 4 minutes. That coupled with the surge tank indication would appear valid. There's more research required in this particular area. And we are getting special plots of the surge tank pressure and flow rate in more detail. This is okay, I've talked about the EKGs. That was the second set of stuff. And then the other corollary information is the outer nimble torque motor from the inertial platform, which would measure very small seconds of arc motion of the spacecraft, and which was sort of disturbed in this time period, very low level disturbance, but nonetheless different from the baseline, and was disturbed kind of from this period on. Okay. It would again appear to be a reaction to something rather than any sort of indication of an electrical malfunction in that system. The next anomaly to be picked up occurs at 55. Remember, 52 is the onset of high flow rate. At 55, there is a C-band problem.
Okay, is that a 50? Are the numbers 52 is onset of high flow rate? I see.
I'm sorry, onset of high heart rate. Okay, high flow rate was over here. 55 was an apparent electrical problem in the C-band system, and let me describe what we see there. at we see a drop in voltage in the C-band decoder output. This is one of the measured signals. It drops to zero for about 2 seconds and then recovers. We are now checking the ground station. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? What signal is it?
This is the C-band decoder output.
That's one of the radars and interrogation
signals. There's a second drop in transmitter power output, which drops to zero at the same time.
Both of them together.
So you wouldn't get a transmitter. Okay. And we're now checking the ground station records to see if we had lost a signal from the spacecraft. And
on what radar was actually.
Exactly. Okay. We're rerunning that data again to get more precision. It could be normal. But there is also then on AC plus B at the same time, all three phases show an increase of 6 to 7 volts. An increase of 6 to 7 volts. And that's essentially instantaneous and drops back in some 200 milliseconds.
It does now, Joe, show 6 volts.
The AC bus B on all three phases. Now, the postulation, and again, this is pure speculation, was that you could have had some kind of an electrical short, which would have either removed voltage to the C-band, and what we were seeing in the C-band signal was its normal recovery time from having voltage removed, or there could have been some short here which pulled the bus down, and then what we were seeing in this, essentially instantaneously for a short time, the order of milliseconds, and then a recovery, and we're seeing the overshoot transient of the recovery when we pick this thing up. The data is fairly crude. It's only being sampled, I think, here about once every half second or so. I'm not sure of that number, but it must be once every
200 milliseconds.
200 milliseconds. It's maybe 5 times a second data. And what we're seeing is just a quick recovery
It's recovering on the bus.
Because normally, if you're thinking short and you see something high, you say, you know, why would it be high? You normally expect to fully hold it down. But if you're snapping back into regulation and the inverters do regulate, you could just see this kind of a trend.
Short burn itself up is pretty
good. Okay. Now, we do need to do some correlating of switch positions and so on in this case, for example, to be sure that this C-band beacon was on bus B. I think in the checklist it's supposed to be on bus B at that time, but these are the kind of things that need to be correlated on switch positions. Now, of course, the...
Where is the C-band switch?
Rick, you know this? C-band is right up in the main town.
Yeah.
Right in front of
the
communications.
The C-band beacon is down in the lower equipment bay on the right hand side. About switch. 2 or 3 units in. The switch is up on the main town.
Got to turn it off. You see the bus coming up because somebody switched it off. You have to talk to it.
All right. Okay, now I should say what we have not yet looked at in terms of data prior to the event. The data we haven't looked at is the GSE data, all the information tied to the GSE and feeding in. We've not yet looked at the discrete events data. They've had trouble stripping that out. We've had several strip outs of it, but no two of them have been consistent, so they're still on a data reduction problem there. I think we'll recover the data, but we haven't had a chance to look at all the discretes that are monitored yet. Okay, now other things that seem to have happened There are some IMU, that's the inertial measurement unit, heater current variations, and some blower current variations. They're relatively slight. They occurred late at around 3112, so we're now down in the time period where the problem is going on and has progressed significantly. There are other voltage variations going on at that point in time. These are possibly correlated with that. We're looking for those kind of correlations.
These heaters now, are they tied in the oxygen system there, Joe? Are those the heater you're speaking of?
No, these are heaters in the inertial measurement unit. The IMU has maintained a temperature there. In effect, strip heaters on the gyros, accelerometers on the platform.
Okay.
So it would be inside the inertial measurement unit itself. There's a blower inside the ball which is circulating air. Okay, but the actual cooling of the IMU is provided from the cold plates, like all circulates do. All right. We did, and I would prefer not to describe it in detail, but there were a number of some things which happened on logic bus A, logic bus B, battery bus A, battery bus B, the post-landing battery bus, and the main buses in the time period of the problem. And they essentially involve switching from the simulated main power, which was the tied in through the fuel cell simulator unit, switching to the entry batteries. And we think that all of those things can be explained. Some of the switching in that area occurs. One bus switches, and then the second bus switches about 2 seconds later. There are some wires which come off a relay called K3 in one of the sequencers as part of the RCS sequencing circuit. If those wires shorted, now this sequencer is external to the pressurized cabin, but are located in the area where you can observe the hole through the pressurized cabin. If those wires burned, for instance, sequentially, they would have caused the sequence that we saw. So that might be a way of identifying the time of burn through or something like that.
Okay.
We do need then for that kind of identification to get in and be able to do some testing on the continuity of the signals, some looking in that particular area and so on to correlate that information. There is a battery manifold which would essentially exhaust excess pressure from the battery out the duct. That battery manifold pressure increased from 15 PSIA, essentially ambient, to 20 PSIA, starting at 3109 in this time frame. We kind of think that rather than indicating a problem with the battery, in other words, a battery breaking or something like that, and venting and causing excess pressure, that this is perhaps just the cabin pressure at that time in which it burned through and you were essentially at the same pressure as the cabin. So this might be a way of indicating cabin pressure going up to about 20 PSI by 09. The cabin pressure measurement itself increased from 16.4 PSI, which was the nominal reading, to 16.9, which is the limit of the reading of the gauge. So the gauge pegged at 3108.46, again in this time period. So that was about the time of the pressure starting to take off in the cabin. The cabin temperature increased. This is cabin temperature is measured at the input to the SU heat exchanger. Increased from 76.4 Fahrenheit, 76.4 Fahrenheit to 125, which is the limit of the gauge again. The gauge peg at 3106.4 in this time. There were some happenings in the suit circuits The flow rate to suit one dropped to zero between 31.14 and 31.18. Out in this time period here, the flow rate to suit three shows a sudden unexplained drop between 09.8, recovery at 12, and it started dropping to zero again at 15.4. This was again in a time period when there's quite a bit going on, and I'm sure we can reproduce these kind of things and see whether it's normal performance or not. Obviously, that has not just performance. So rate to suit 2 shows momentary drop tendency between 14 and 15.2. The flow rate starts to drop to 0 at 16, so it's kind of all the suits are going out in the 14, 15, 16 time. In the glycol system, the differential pressure across the compressor, which is now the sort of total flow in the glycol system, stayed steady at 8 tenths of a PSI and had a slight increase to about 9 tenths of a PSI by the time of loss of data, which would indicate the glycol system working perhaps properly.
The glycol circulating system that's being pumped all the time?
Yes, sir. It's the circulating system. It's the coolant that goes through the heat exchanger down into the service module and through the radiators. It flows through the suit heat exchanger and also flows through all the cold plates for the electronic system.
Would that, for this short of time, for sure, indicate that you did not have a downstream leak?
Let me read one more thing. The glycol pump outlet pressure was constant until 13.4, and then it rose from 53.3 to 59.5 at the time of loss of data. Now, I don't know how you interpret that. The pressures are rising rather than dropping in both cases, and it could be its temperature effects and things like this. When I first looked at that data, it looked like the glycol loop might have broken. I kind of conclude from this that the glycol loop was probably still intact. The glycol pump inlet pressure was constant until 31.11, when it began to rise. And we do need things like reservoir valve positions and that sort of stuff to understand the entire glycol system. And we probably want to check the integrity of the system to see if it's still pressure.
Well, I think, for example, we want to be pretty sure and see if over that period of time that could be consistent with just being pumped out somewhere. It's enough.
Well, it's reservoir. The glycol, there is a reservoir. The glycol cumulative pressure was constant. So 09.4, and then it began to rise. And I think if you put all that together, the pressures are going up in the system. That's around the time that the temperatures are going up, and that's probably a consistent picture of the fluid just expanding and getting out. The oxygen regulator, the O2 regulator, was steady until 31.12, and then a gradual decline began. Okay, that gentleman is the sum of the things we've been able to get out of the data.
Have you been able to look at all the data, except for this
Except for the events and the GSE, I believe all the data have been accounted for. Okay, and more than once. It's been stripped out, it's been digitized, the digital prints are available up there. And then the critical ones, and we haven't gone back and sort of gone fine grain and everything, we'll get that done. But the critical ones, everything that looked like any kind of a bottle at all, was picked up and identified. And this is what came up.
Well, it would be interesting to know if there's any kind of a sensor of any kind around there in that earlier time period that indicates a change in temperature.
Yes,
sir. Down the that lower deck down there where it was, I don't think that high.
The only
anything that, any monitoring that reflects
the only
change.
The only anticipatory thing at all that we have been able to see is the heart rate and the keying of the box. Or keying of the circuit. I guess the last thing to point out is that in this time period, after the second voice transmission. Deke, you might want to comment, but it would appear that Eddie made that voice transmission and then tried to get Nash. Chappie stating his seats.
Yeah, that's an opinion. We'll talk more about that whenever you want to. I don't have a base from about that.
The last question was sidewalks issues.
Yes.
You were on the service module's radio, say you're a little obvious.
I think so. I don't know for sure. I shouldn't say.
I think that's right. Well, with by that.
That's the GSC.
In the service company.
I can't.
Not that. I think probably get that off the GSC.
Yeah, all right, it's a good point. Okay. Well, thank you, Joe. I think we, that was what we want to go into now. One of the things that we thought we would like to see if there's something that we can do about. Public examination plans for the section. Not to start the section, but to see if there are things in the plan that we would like to expand. Now, we don't know just what has been done. We've been out there and looked at this thing, and we just wondered what is the best approach to getting in a position to start, to actually take a thing apart when they're ready. And who,
Mr. Patrick, could I make one other observation? Because I was supposed to make this plea that there are things that we need from the spacecraft, and they're kind of listed there as a first cut in order to get on with the understanding of just this data, these data. And I guess we'd like to see if we couldn't set up a system so that we can begin to go in and look selectively at things. And I suspect that our system people, as they continue to look, will have more than just switch positions and that sort of stuff that they're going to want to get to within a couple of days, maybe sooner.
Get inside,
make measurements on the spacecraft, and perhaps even take out a selective system or two, or look in a particular area if we have some indication that that's an area where we may mine some gold in the problem. So, my point is that interaction with the spacecraft, because of the paucity of this data, will probably be very important.
Well, we're postulating what the approach to actually uncovering anything too, and getting at it from the outside, let's say, without disturbing inside, you can sort of stick these things somehow or other by taking off heat shields or opening up or actually cutting out what to uncover where we would like to look. And I don't know what we want to do about it. I think what we will probably need there will be a combination of things, including some people who are very conversant with other things fabricated to know what can be taken off, perhaps, and so forth. And we took one look there to see how far down the fire went. And at least we went down below it. But it was, down on the seventh deck, it was pretty hot.
there's a fire down in there, and we certainly want to be sure that we go down as far as the fire went in our exploration, expose it. When it comes to the command module, that's a problem of what can be taken off without disrupting things too much in the way of the that outer shell, honeycomb thing, whatever it is.
There has been a plan worked up for the board's consideration, I think.
Well, that's, I understood it. They've been planning on that. I think we would like to know something about that and see if that satisfies what we think is...
We have some outlines here.
This chairman's not fast, but don't you think you just have to go in before you can get to any more? Make a postulate, this could be it. You know, in the 248 accident a couple of years ago, we just sat down and said, well, this could have been the way it happened, and we mocked it up and we tried it, and sure enough, we reproduced it.
Well,
but
you heard what I told you.
Can't get that.
It's a pretty thin database to weave a story. Now, I think we're going to find that there are selective things here, okay, and that the list of things I have here probably do not represent a major violation of the system. Some of these are merely just looking to see where are things. Some of these do represent measurements which means you're beginning to touch wires now. Thank you. I think the board will have to decide whether we just want to take the, because of the total paucity of the data, we want to kind of take the whole spacecraft apart and just redevelop it like an archaeological job, or whether you want to use whatever tool you have to try and pinpoint what the problem may have been. I suspect it's a choice where you can go either way and be equally rigorous. This may get us some data a little bit quicker. And these first things are really, really gentle. And the more that people start thinking, the more they're going to start asking questions. And we'll try to control a certain part of those questions so that they make sense before they ever come in. And they're thought through and so on. And it'll probably be a longer list, but a long one.
You think it would be wise to put them in the order of the decreasing gentility, so to speak?
Well,
some of these you can look at pretty quickly.
In which position you can go around? Sure, you can.
Yeah.
Is there a mask of any of that in which position? There are photographs
that
are
included. Maybe you can take the quarter of technicians who went in and verify the position of every
shot. I guess we're kind of saying the condition of those guys.
One technician described that the size of the crack and the forward pressure in the lower pressure ball.
Well, let me get going on this. You can see that. There were three of us, one from each organization, that looked over the hardware at a high degree of detail, and we concluded that it appears to be structurally sound, unless there was a major separation of the longerons from the honeycomb. In other words, there's no problem supporting the launch escape system above it. It weighs some 8,000 pounds. We looked into the ordnance that was installed on board. The launch escape system shows no charring at all, so obviously it didn't get very hot. The ordnance installed around the umbilical, the guillotining, did not go off, And if you look at the tape surrounding cables in that area, it didn't melt very much, so there wasn't really an appreciable amount of heat in that area. And also, there was no evidence we could find of the ordnance in the forward deck having been fired. So we concluded that with the single exception of possibly not having good shorting for the forward deck ordnance, the ordnance on board is safe now. There aren't any initiators, and there's nothing that's very sensitive. The tankage obviously survived the fire, which was its most sensitive point. And while we have a survey going on about the pressures in each tank, they're going to come out somewhat nominal. Pad pressures like 50 pounds in a 300-400 pound tank, things of this nature. We have a detailed review for some people to tell us how you would really tell what was inside each tank without disturbing anything, and then what they suggest to do about it if you wanted to save them. But there are nominal pressures, very minor, in almost all the tanks. The batteries, before anybody really got in there, I think they should look around for batteries, brasses, bills, and things like this, which would be dangerous to personnel.
One question occurs to me at this point is whether what the possibility is that there's any dripping out of the spacecraft that might be doing damage to the stages below.
Well, we looked around the whole area, and the only drippage we found was from some of this dark rubber material that melted and fell down on the lower part. There was a little water dripping through the decks, but it didn't come from the spacecraft. So there appeared to be no leakage.
Well, it occurred to me it might be worthwhile to put some kind of biofilm or something down in the IU instrument unit and start trying to protect the vehicle.
It looked pretty clean up there as we looked up through the
but you could have asked you got a battery bolt.
Well, it will drop into the heat shield compartment rather than open.
But that's where it will fall over. Okay, heat shield collector.
We also ran a study of toxic materials. There is beryllium in the guidance system. It's in pretty deep, but of course it wouldn't form beryllium oxide with a high enough temperature, and that's a little dangerous. So this is going on now. Our basic recommendation was for most of your work, leave it where it is, because you have a better chance to keep the evidence there. The access is equally difficult no matter where you put it.
Well, how do you get access down
Okay, let me go a little bit further, and I think when you get to that stage, it will be time to move it. But right now, we're suggesting that you do roughly four things in parallel. Obviously, finish the data review, and there's only about half the data that's come in. The rest should be in tomorrow. This will be all of the data from all parallel sources. There were only a limited number of pictures taken, and none apparently after astronaut removal. We think that with good lighting, a large number of interior photographs should be taken. And these should be given to the system people who are looking at data to look at where their hardware is and see if there's a possible connection between data and condition. This type of approach still requires nobody inside it to destroy evidence. And that should work up this business of the system safety to see if it's really dangerous where it is. Also, too, along the same line that should be going on now is this, what we call an initial inspection list. The first things that people want to see. Now, under the assumption, then, that as you find out what the data says, you have questions about what the hardware should connect to it, somebody's going to have to go in and look. We worked up a little diagram of how you might control this. Now, there is a team that's collecting data. It's got a management head to it, and all system people report to. This team could take all of these requirements and screen them and present them to you all for detailed approval. We could use our existing paperwork systems that line things out line by line. Then we could establish on the deck one expert. We have two or three, a fellow like Ernie Reyes, that are real good, and one of the expert technicians that know in detail the inside of the command module, and let these people carry out the first initial look-see. And if you get the right quality people, of course, nothing will be disturbed. We would also suggest that a log be made of exactly each and everything they do. And then if you limit this to two people, it won't be often through there. Now, then after this is done,
obviously it's time to get everybody back together and sit down and decide what to do next. We think you should approach it like this with the work control procedure, because if you move it now, you destroy the capability to actually power it up and test it. And there is the possibility that when you're all done, your data and your inspection will have shown you nothing, and the only other results will be to power it up and test it. If you want to get to this state before you start to disassemble it piece by piece. Now, we're all ready to move it. We have a place to put it and transporters and things like this to take it to. That's basically what I have to offer at this time.
But you've been there exactly.